Debbie, how are you?
I'm fine, Phil. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing very good. Film is released as of a couple days ago, so I'm taking a big deep breath finally, so that's kind of nice.
Well, I have to tell you, I'm so excited to get to speak with you about Laws of Man. I wanted to speak with you about Condor's Nest, but for whatever reason, that never manifested because I'm so in love with Condor's Nest. So, you have such a great spin on stories. You take fact and you manipulate it and twist it with such creativity. You did that with Condor's Nest, and you have done that again with Laws of Man. I'm telling you, I did not see that third act twist coming.
Well, I really appreciate the kind words. That's great. You know, as the writer, you know, I really took a chance. This was always going to be a love it or hate it ending. People were either going to say, you know, this is awesome, never saw this coming. What a fun way to work in one of America's greatest conspiracy theories with a twisted jolty coming, or people were going to say, it came untethered from reality. This is ridiculous. And it was always going to be a coin flip, which one of those directions it took. So. And we're still kind of figuring it out. We're seeing what people think. But I'm glad you enjoyed it. I think it's great.
And I got to tell you, when you look at how you lead up to it and the Benjamin Bonney aspect, and as things come out about, we learn things about that. And then we meet Keith Carradine's character of Galen Armstrong, a not so nice FBI guy. And you start putting pieces together, and then when we get this big twist in Act 3, and you think about history itself, it's like, yeah, this is plausible.
Sure. Well, and that's, you know, that's the key to writing something like that. You know, it's about as ungrounded as you can get as far as the material, but, you know, giving yourself a plausible deniability you operate within a framework, and, you know, you can't go outside the bounds of it. It has to have been in some way plausible historically.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, if something like that ever happened, none of us would ever know about it. So there's that deniability aspect of, well, who's to say it didn't happen? Which is fun as a writer. It's a lot of fun as a writer. So, and, you know, on the producer side, it gives you the chance to meld neo-Western, you know, visual style, you know, mm-hmm. the big wide sweeping, you know, Western plains, and then meld that of all things with a missile silo. So it's a lot of fun. It was indulgent in a lot of ways, but a lot of fun too.
That just blew me away. But as I'm watching it, it's like, yeah, this is something that very plausible, very easily could have happened and shoved under the rug. So
sure. Yeah, there's stuff even today being declassified about missile silo accidents that happened, and, you know, stuff that people never knew about was going on with the nuclear program in the U.S. back during the Cold War. So, you know, who's to say this isn't one of them?
Now, where did the idea for Laws of Man come from? Did you sit at breakfast one day eating cornflakes and think, hey, this is pretty cool?
No, it was, I have always admired neo-Western films. You know, neo-Western being films like No Country for Old Men, where they're shot in the American West, and they have the visual tradition of a classic Western, but it's set in a relative modern day. You know, No Country for Old Men was in the 80s, this is in the 60s, but, you know, it's not horse and carriage days. And so I've always loved that visual medium, and I wanted to explore that and do something fun with it and meld it with, in the indie sphere with film. You have to, at the end of the day, you can't indulge yourself completely in what you want to do. You have to you have to reach consumer bases and make sure you can make your money back and go on to the next one. And so I wanted to find a way to blend it with some World War II stuff to try to appeal to that demographic. You know, it usually is something that people really key onto. So found a way to work in a character study of PTSD and trauma and sort of lost memories. You know, found a way to kind of work that in. And, you know, to be completely honest, I don't remember what the political intrigue worked itself in. It just, I wanted to do something left turnish with it, you know, where we just take a hard left at the end of the movie, and it just sort of manifested itself. I have a long And my first film was a Vietnam War film, and my master's degree was studying representation of the public memory of the Vietnam War in Vietnamese spaces of memory. And so, yeah, I've always been extremely interested in that aspect of things. And, yeah, it just kind of was, like I said, a little bit of indulgence, self-indulgence there. It was a chance to dabble in some stuff that, you know, I don't know when I'm ever going to get to, you know, put pen to paper on it. And here was a chance to just do something imaginative and fun. And, you know, there we ended up with it.
For me, this makes perfect sense for you as a next film after Condor's Nest, because you're focused on World War II and Condor's Nest. Now you come forward 20 years, and we've got Laws of Man, but as you just said, you bring in the holdover, that PTSD from World War II, Vietnam, not Vietnam because we hadn't gotten there yet, but from World War II. And I like that progression in you as a storyteller. It fits.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. You know, I think, I think what was interesting about this one is, you know, we pulled some big names on this movie.
You did.
And when you pull in, and you know, when you pull in heavyweights like that, it kind of gives you the opportunity to pull out of the B movie malaise, right? You know, with your low budget movies where you don't have a big cast, you have to have bang bang and shoot 'em up and, you know, all the action to keep people interested. But, you know, pulling all these names in allowed me as a writer to really kind of dive into the characterizations. And, you know, I wouldn't call it a character piece. It's not really a character-driven movie, but it allowed me some depth. I was able to build some layers and a lot of subtext into the characters and, you know, their individual struggles. And, you know, that always is something that actors love to stick their teeth into. You know, they don't have to just hop out in front of the camera and say a dumb line, "Oh, I'm going to get you, bad guy." You know, it's there's a lot of meat there. There's a lot of layers for them to sink their teeth into. And so, you know, I think that was rewarding as a writer, being able to take that next step and, you know, then pulling on the Harvey Keitels and the Keith Carradines of the world to come in and take those roles. So, yeah, just really rewarding in a lot of ways.
You've got some real heavy hitters here, especially Harvey Keitel as Cassidy Whittaker. I mean, Harvey, just that's an award-worthy performance that he gives.
Oh my gosh, he was so good.
Oh my God. And Keith, I love Keith. And we always catch up every year at TCM Film Festival. This has now been a ritual. So
wow.
I'm anxious that come April I can talk to him about this film at TCM.
Yeah.
Keith is just amazing. Graham Greene, who I have loved for decades. And of course, you've got Forey in there, who's riding high, picking up pieces thanks to Yellowstone. And Dermot, my God, Dermot has taken a shift from being the nice guy next door to playing these darker, sinister, twisted kind of roles. Of course, it was so nice to see you bring back Jackson and Jacob, who you had in Condor's Nest. And watching the two of them feed off of each other, that pairing and partnership is really fun to watch. But all of these intersecting dynamics, you have given depth to every one of these main characters. They are fully fleshed out, three-dimensional. And with this many characters, I find that rare, shall we say.
Sure.
Most times you'll see one or two, maybe three main characters fully fleshed out. But here, you have so many.
Oh, yeah. No, sorry. I was just going to say, you know, that is a testament to the actors themselves. You know, that's not just lip service, you know. We brought in these folks, you know, just, you know, speaking of Jake and Jackson, you know, they had a great couple of scenes in Condor's Nest. There was so much chemistry kind of built off of there that we just wanted to, you know, if we were going to match Jacob with somebody, you know, those were our two guys, you know. It just felt like a great match. And, you know, you always worry if the chemistry isn't there that it's going to fall flat, especially something that, you know, there are humorous beats. And, you know, it's not just straight-laced the entire time. And, you know, those guys came in and did the work and just knocked it out of the park. And, you know, keep it. I mean, I've got nothing, you know, but glowing things to say about everybody, you know, across the board. Harvey came in and, I mean, you know, I think he's 86 now. And, you know, he moves with the speed and the agility of a man 20 years younger. And, you know, he just came in and, you know, he did so much preparation. I mean, he probably was that he brought to the table. Just an absolutely, just a sweet guy. And then Keith, my gosh, Keith was he's the easiest actor I've ever had the pleasure of working with. He came in and, there's always a little bit of a gulf between, how you hear the character in your head and, how the actor takes it and, how they do it. And, it obviously becomes a collaboration between the writer-director who has one vision and the actor who has the other. Well, Keith came in and, I mean, from the first beat coming off of action on his very first scene, everything came out exactly the way I heard it in my head.
Just, wow.
It was absolutely on time. And it's funny, whenever I get these bigger names on set, I always check with them. A lot of these guys are used to working in big studio projects where there's stand-ins and photo doubles, and once the camera's off them, a lot of times some of these people will opt to step out and have to stand in, be their over-the-shoulder, body double or photo double while the other actor's doing coverage and they're back off to the trailer. And so I always ask, hey, are you okay? Standing in here and doing the scene even though the coverage isn't on you, so the other actors got something to play off of. And I asked Keith that, and he looked at me, almost offended, and he was like, "Of course." He's like, "I'm here till the scene's done." And I was like, "Cool, that's great. I appreciate it. I always want to check." And it was like, "Listen, my father, the legendary John Carradine, of course.
Yep.
He was like, my father told me from day one, you don't leave the damn room till the scene's over. The other actors are there giving you something to play off of. You're getting paid. You stay in the room and do it till the scene's done. Doesn't matter how, who you are or who they are, you're there till it's over." So, and he told me, I'm here till the whistle.
Yeah.
He was, and he did a fantastic job. And it was a whole lot of fun. And so, that goes double for everybody. That's just an incredible cast that we brought on. A lot of logistical work went into making that happen, and there's a lot to keep up with on the production side for a small production, and we were grateful for them coming and playing ball with the little guys. So I think they all did a fantastic job, and we're really happy with the result.
As well you should be. Now, I've got to talk to you about working with, again, you bring back your crew from Condor's Nest. You got Daniel Troyer in as your DP, and then Nico is your editor again. But I want to talk to you about developing your visual grammar with Daniel on this one. Because, number one, your location is spectacular. We feel the desolation. There's a timeless quality to the location you've chosen. And then the way you and Daniel have shot this, your visual grammar that you've designed, but also you give us a heightened sense of, I'm detecting slight saturation happening, especially when we get into the interior. So it's almost unreal, but then we're realizing, no, this is very real. So talk to me about designing this visually to get the visual tonal bandwidth you have and working with Daniel again.
This was, and thank you for asking that. This is maybe the coolest question I've been asked, because it's the indulgent one that I love talking about. But Daniel and I, we worked together in Condor's Nest. We've got a long history there, and kind of developed a rapport working on that. And early on in the concept with Laws of Man, Daniel and I, we were sitting down in pre-production meetings, kind of putting together the production design and what we wanted to bring to the table visually. And, I had already scouted locations, and, I knew we were going to film in New Mexico, and I had a lot of the background work kind of done there. But then the next step was to say, okay, how do we take a film that has, a lot going on, a lot of subtext, a lot of context, a lot of different dynamics, and infuse, as you said, our visual grammar to build the syntax of this particular film.
Mm-hmm.
We were very particular in taking dynamics, even down to the color grading. And I'll start with the color grading first. There were scenes where we wanted to play with this idea of a surreality, right? This sort of surreal setting. So much of the, you have a lot of the elements of questioning the nature of reality in this film. And, things that happen that make you wonder if certain characters were actually real, or if this was someone's imagination, or so on. It gets very epistemological in that way. And so there are scenes where the color grading sort of plays a part of that. When this is obviously a spoiler for our audiences, and I don't know how this gets typed up, but it becomes saturated. And, you know, there's the flashback scenes, you know, get really blue and desaturated, and you know, there's a lot of just really kind of monkeying with things that we can control. Even small technical things like the opening scene the shootout in the desert at the beginning of the movie is supposed to be Utah, where everything else is supposed to be Nevada. So we really cranked up the oranges and the reds and really tried to bring out the red rocks just to visually separate it from the desolation of the rest of the movie. And so, yeah, there was a lot of kind of work that went into that. And, you know, also going for... I'm personally a fan of locked-off wide shots. And so the extent to which we could use those and use them, especially with... we had old 70s Kauer lenses, so they were these 1970s anamorphics.
Uh-huh.
A lot of character and really kind of fit that visual style. And so, you know, it wasn't just slapping letterboxes on it to make it look like a, 239 CinemaScope super wide, like you see in those Bossy films. You know, those were shot on the lenses. They were using those films back then. And so, you know, we wanted to just sort of imbue it with that classic look. You know, take the neo-Western part of a neo-Western or the neo-part of a Western, you know, and really kind of do that. And so, yeah, that was a lot of fun for us to dabble in. And, you know, of course, you also want to appeal to modern audiences. So, you know, we have plenty of the big aerials with the drone, you know, some spectacular stuff and a lot of dolly work, you know, a lot of the big pushes and, you know, the jibs and booms and the rises and the falls of the camera, just to imbue it with a sense of, modern movement and, you know, sort of kinetic energy.
Mm-hmm.
So we couldn't be completely self-indulgent, but yeah, it was, I could go on forever, but I'll stop there. There was a lot involved, and there was a lot of work to take every cell of the organism here, of the film, and you know, mold it into precise the story that we wanted to tell, and it was a lot of fun in that regard.
No, and it looks very cinematic. It plays very cinematically, and it looks very cinematic as you're watching this. It's very full-bodied from a visual standpoint. And I really like that because it's a full-bodied story that you're telling. So it's a perfect marriage there of your emotional tonal bandwidth and your visual tonal bandwidths. The editing is so key here. Once you have all this beautiful footage, Nico's work and finding pacing here, because of the offshoots, because of the multi-layered story that we have happening here, the editing is crucial. So, you know, how challenging was the editing process on Laws of Man?
Credit obviously goes to the editor himself, Nico. Nico's just a phenomenal human being and an unbelievably talented editor. He edited Condor's Nest before Laws of Man.
Yep.
And, so Nico and I kind of developed a language between us and a back and forth in how we put these things together. That really kind of took it to the next level for Laws of Man. Nico spends weeks on end, you know, assembling the shots and developing a rough assembly, and then I come out and usually a couple of the production partners will come out, or sometimes group producers or whoever. And we'll sit there and chop it up, and we'll go scene by scene. And you know, with Nico, it's always been easy. Nico's always instinctively understood the language of the film and exactly what we've been going for. And he always every time he nails what we're going for, and we never have to make big changes. It's always coming in making tweaks. You know, add a frame or two here, pull back there, and you know, and at that point, it just becomes about agreeing on what the beats are, you know, and sort of coming through and finding the moments. You know, Nico likes to talk about finding moments. And so, you know, there are, you know, little expressions on faces. Or an example is when one of the coolest things he did, I wanted to do this sort of wide shot when Tommy's walking across and they realize that the warrant's been pulled. And Tommy puts down the phone and he walks over to Frank to announce that the wire was stolen, and Nico was like, "Look, let me try something," and he dropped this tighter shot in of a panning shot following Jackson. It was kind of close up. I originally didn't want to use it, of him walking back to Frank, and he looks over his shoulder at Benjamin Bonney, Dermot Moroney,
mm-hmm.
and does this kind of nervous laugh, this almost embarrassed grin that kind of flashes across his face for a moment, and Nico great, you know, that that brought, you know, just kind of a little human moment into it. And we got to see a little glimpse inside something there, add some depth. And, you know, Nico's been great about that. He's been great about finding moments and working them into to it, you know. And of course, all the technical skills are there, too. I mean, my gosh, it was a tough shoot. We had a ton of footage that we shot, and there was a lot going on. And, you know, there were times that we painted Nico into a corner simply because we, you know, there's strong winds, you know, blowing shots at the, you know, hitting shots at the wrong time, and, you know, just different lighting issues with sunlight and overheads. And, you know, there were just so many things that were a liability on the day when we were filming it that just made it harder on Nico and gave him less options as far as what he could do. And I'll be damned if he didn't come out aces every time. I mean, he just did a phenomenal job. So, yeah, I can't say enough good things about Nico.
Well, you know, and that's a testament, too, to what Daniel has captured and what he has delivered. When you don't have a lot of options, when you have something good to work with to start with, you can make that work in lieu of having 10 different options to do something. But I love the balancing act that Nico has done here with the editing, because we get to see two sides. All of these characters, two sides of a coin, every one of them. And we really get, and be it just a look, an over-the-shoulder look that he brings in, it speaks so loudly. So there is no need for exposition to detract from the unfolding story and all of these offshoots that are happening to come together in that third act. Really, really impressive. You also bring in your score here. Interesting musically. What were you were you looking for, Phil?
Oh my gosh. So I am musically illiterate as far as these things are concerned. So every drop of credit goes to Ching Shan, our composer extraordinaire. She came in. We sat her down in Sugar Studios where we did all our post production, and we interviewed her, and we sort of walked through the rough cut of the film and had her kind of spitball, you know, what she was thinking and, you know, what she was thinking she would bring to the table. And and she wanted she drew inspiration from oh my gosh, of course now I'm not gonna remember the name of the film. The Leonardo DiCaprio film that came out a couple years ago in Oklahoma. What's the name of that damn film?
I'm blanking on it myself.
Oh my god, what a bunch of Academy Awards. I'll think of it. You'll think of it too. She wanted to pull from that, you know, something that had, you know, classical composition and arrangements, but had a modern bent on it, and I think the word that she used was harrowing. She wanted to sort of take this idea that we built into the film of a descent into something uncanny and unfamiliar, and you know, play that, but also you know, keep it grounded, you know, not a horror movie, you know. And see. I wish I could be more literate in how I'm talking about the process here. Like I said, it's not at all my area of expertise, but, you know, she came in from an early point and just took the reins, and, you know, the first couple of sketch compositions where she just, you know, put together a couple scenes with some ideas and, you know, themes for Frank and Tommy. We see certain musical motifs that come up whenever Frank and Tommy are together and sort of investigating or working on something or in action. She was able to weave those throughout the film and, you know, and just did a wonderful job of matching moods and, you know, playing up to, you know, action or drama, but also working very seamlessly different motifs in there and different themes. And yeah, I can't say enough. I think she did a wonderful job. She's the best damn composer on the planet as far as I'm concerned. So, yeah, she was great.
And I love the richness of the score because, here again, it fits with the richness of the cinematography, of the color, and of the character development. Works really, really well. And by the way, it just dawned on me, Killers of the Flower Moon, Scorsese's movie.
There you go, that's it. Yeah. That's it. Yeah, so she drew some inspiration from that. That was one of the ones she brought up as sort of an inspiration sonically for how she wanted to approach it. So, yeah, I think she nailed it.
Just wonderful. So, now, if you had to pick, what was the most challenging aspect of bringing Laws of Man to life?
Oh, gosh, well, I think, you know, being a period piece without a big studio backing you is incredibly challenging because you have to juggle multiple things at once. You know, you can't, you've got props and you've got wardrobe and, you know, you've got your vehicles and your locations. You have all these elements that go together. You know, if you see one anachronistic car, or if you see one power line where it shouldn't be, the entire illusion is broken. And so with very limited resources, it becomes an incredible challenge to find all these things and to put them in the single place where you can actually handle them day to day. And, you know, you find yourself having to do post-production to fix things because you don't want to, you know, to break the illusion. You know, painting out power lines, painting out contrails in the sky, and, you know, random old phone booth from the 1980s, and you've got to paint that out because it's 1963, and, you know, and just so many constituent elements that go into building that world for an audience and not taking them out of it at any moment. So, yeah, I would say collectively just shooting something that's supposed to be 1963 in 2023, 60 years later, is just an incredible challenge in every respect. So easily that.
Now that you have this done, now that everybody gets to see this film, and as you look back on it, what did you learn about yourself as a filmmaker in making this film that you can take forward into your future films?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, I think I'm going to stop doing period pieces. there's some truth to that. You know, I think I have realized that that trying to do 20 different things and not executing on all of them is not as advisable as narrowing a concept. And instead of trying to elevate a genre, you know, mixing, you know, different things, you know, as fun as that was, you know, I think the next film that I do will be a little bit more narrow of a focus, a little bit more clearly set within a genre, and will not be a period piece, simply to allow myself to focus, on directing the actors and executing on the vision. I think as fun as it's been doing the last couple films, coming from the independent film side, you know, I'm wearing 18 different hats while we're out there filming, and you know, I'm having to, you know, this is not to take anything away from our phenomenal wardrobe folks, and you know, people in hair and makeup, and people handling props, but a lot of the lead-up has been on myself and Jacob Kahane, the lead actor. I mean, my gosh, Jake and I, as producers, for the last two films, we're building these damn props ourselves. I mean, the cigarette machine, Jake refurbished by hand.
Oh, my God.
Over the summer, we filmed. And in Condor's Nest, the B-17, I slept in a mule barn for 2 years in a hammock, freezing my ass off in the winters, building that thing from the ground up by hand across from a French farmhouse that was a full structure. It was not green screened, and so you know, and then obviously you get on the day on the set, and you know, talking about Condor's Nest, you're worried about wind, and you're up there with a screw gun at, you know, 4 a.m. the night before, you know, making sure that metal's not popping off the plane. Or in Laws of Man, you know, there's you know, it just constantly show running, you know, having to babysit so many things that can go wrong because of the different elements that we brought in. And that can be distracting, right? It takes you away from the script. It gets your head out of you know, the clouds where you want to be. You want to be in the clouds as the director. You know, you want to be creating and building something with the story. But you know, when you're a mechanic at the same time, and you know, you're tightening up bolts and you're making sure everybody's going to get fed and so on, and you know, it detracts from the process, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And so I think I, in the future, want to try to narrow my vision a little bit, make something that's, you know, it's still interesting to watch, still a fun story to tell, but something that lets me focus on going 110% on the things I want to go 110% on, which is not the actual production side. So, yeah, that's what I would say. That's a long way around.
Well, I cannot wait to see what you come up with next, Phil.
Because, oh, my God, thank you.
Because, I mean, between Condors and Laws of Man, I love them both. And it's for all those details, all those challenges, all those things that you have to worry about, that you have worried about so well in both films, to bring them to life, fully realized, with nothing extraneous, and just serving the incredible stories that you're telling. So I'm in there. I can't wait to see what you come up with. Thank you for taking time to talk with me this morning about Laws of Man. This has been fun, and I hope we get to do it again. I hope we get to do it again in the future.
I'm sure we'll connect again on the next one. Absolutely.
I sure hope so. Phil, thank you so much.